It's really a great pleasure to be here. And I have to say, I'm kind of frustrated that I can't stay for tomorrow. I had an opportunity to go through most of the papers that were prepared for this, and they're really a splendid collection of papers which I hope are going to see considerable wider reading than just the campus community here. As I think about what faces us with the various currents that are buffeting scholarly communication, one of the things that's clear is that we need an extended conversation on our campuses that crosses disciplines in a way that it's been hard for us to do in the past. And I think that the collection of papers here was just a wonderful way of starting to open that conversation by looking at some of the critical issues through the lens of specific disciplinary tradition, practice, publishing behaviors, and other kinds of issues. And I think we desperately need more of this kind of conversation. So I'd urge you to think about how to sort of take what you're doing here and show it to other institutions as a model and as sort of a leadership model for how they might bring their conversations forward, because I can tell you that there are many, many campus communities around the country who are struggling with the question of how to address these issues, just as you are engaging them here. I thought that I would spend my time, and I promise I will only go on about 30 minutes, and hopefully that will leave us with a little time for conversation if you all have the energy. I thought I would spend a little time perhaps trying to frame some of the themes that you're going to be spending time on tomorrow and look at four big issues, crises, if you want to call them crises, flashpoints, if you prefer, in the arena of scholarly communication that are very much on my radar screen. And I want to sort of note going in, and I'll return to this as I sum up, that in each case, the problems are real, but our ability to own those problems, our ability to directly address the problems, the kinds of tactics that are necessary to start grappling with the problems are radically different. In some cases, we are looking at things where I sort of look at this and I think, there's almost no excuse for what's going on. We have no one but ourselves to blame, and we really can clean this up with just a little bit of determined effort now that we understand the consequences of doing what we're doing. In other cases, I think it's a long, complex, and hard to resolve place where at best the academy can provide, you know, some public policy input that maybe will help to offset some of the other forces speaking for other positions and other interests. So let me just run through these, and I'll cover them in highly variable depth, but I want to at least get them out there. The first set of questions is really fundamentally economic. These range from the journal crisis, which I think has been exquisitely well documented in papers for this convocation and other literature. You all know about this. It started in the science. It's now spread into the social sciences as well. And it's been building up for really pushing 30 years now. And basically, you just look at sort of, you know, here's the curve of price increases, here's the curve of budget increases, something is going to have to give. The question of what we do about that is one that a lot of people have thought about, and I know you'll spend some time on tomorrow. It's a difficult problem because there are a lot of entrenched economic players. There are perverse incentives. On the other hand, there are also some just sort of powerful ideas now that are getting loose, like the idea of open access, where you gather up a whole series of arguments. The argument that this improves scholarship by making scholarly material more accessible. The argument that it opens to the public research, particularly in areas like the health sciences, where the public is one of the major funders of research. It begins to address the inequities between rich institutions and poor institutions, both on a national basis and on a global basis. And that's a powerful idea, too. So you see this kind of collection of arguments being marshaled, and they really do offer a powerful vision going forward. How much they solve the economic crisis, how quickly they have impact there, I don't know. I almost wonder whether the pursuit of the vision ultimately is more important than getting bogged down in the details of the economic crisis. I want to say just a couple of other things about economics, though, and I'm giving the specific economics around the journal crisis somewhat short shrift because it has been so well covered by others. We also have some hard questions to struggle with about scarcity, about audience, about cost of production. And let me just give you one example here. While the big economic crisis is probably still in science journals, there's a big scholarly crisis around the health of the system of monographic publishing that is so critical in the humanities and some of the social sciences, the places where journal articles really don't matter that much and where the monograph, typically the university press monograph, is really the sort of stock in trade of scholarship. Now, what's happened is that the market for a typical monograph has diminished. You know, they used to do these in print runs of, say, 800 or 900 typically, maybe 1,000. Now they're selling more like 200 in some areas. There are actually specific areas of the humanities and social sciences, certain kinds of area studies, for example, where it's virtually impossible to get published now. And this is a disaster for our next generation of scholars as long as we think in terms of the monograph as stock in trade. Yet there's something weird going on here, and I just want to kind of underscore the oddity. A lot of these monographs seem to have very small audiences. I don't know whether this is true or not, and you can actually ask the question about, is it our distribution that makes the audiences small, or is it truly the nature of the monograph? And before you get out the butterfly nets to take me away, let me just observe that one of the things that we're seeing when we put things up on the net for unfettered public access is phenomenal usage rates, which have, you know, sort of no precedent in anything we've understood before. We are starting to see some institutions mount programs, for example, where they put up stuff like undergraduate theses or master's theses for public access. Now, you'd think nobody reads this? Some of these theses are clocking 5, 7, 10,000 downloads a month. I don't know who's reading them, but somebody's really interested in these. So one of the things we are finding is that if you open things up in a certain way on the net, maybe some of our intuition about just how esoteric this is might be wrong. But let's assume it's right for a minute. Now, I have heard what I consider to be well-justified skepticism about the amount of value add that the publication process provides for journal articles. In a world where they don't do any copy editing and they're expecting camera-ready copy from the authors, I don't see a whole lot of value add, and I see a whole lot of journal articles that were obviously written by people whose first, second, and third languages were not English, and that's not their fault, but there was clearly no editorial intervention to improve it. Books are different. University Press books in the humanities, they really do edit these things. They spend a lot of money editing these things and sending them out for third-party review. They, you know, proudly speak of boiling down an unreadable 400-page thesis into a pretty readable 200-page book. There really is, you know, some evidence that they do that. But if the readership on these things is on the order of 50, 100, can we afford to do that? This is one of these questions that we just don't want to think about, but I fear we have to in the context of this kind of economics. Let me leave economics behind, though, having raised those questions, and talk about the real monster from the point of view of higher education. That's the whole changing practice of scholarship and of the documentation of that scholarship. This is where all of the things about e-research, about new media, about collaborative environments, about doing different kinds of science come in. This is about the fact that we don't just communicate scholarship through words, we communicate it through structured data, we communicate it through software and models, through visualizations and animations, and that we need somehow to manage all of this for the future. Most of this is taking place in a sort of a parallel universe that has very little to do with the traditional scholarly publishing system. Yes, there are a few intersections, there are a few notable points of innovation. I give, for example, the historians in partnership with the Mellon Foundation a lot of credit for trying to get the profession of history to think hard and critically about what do the children of the scholarly monograph look like on the net in history. And I think that there are some very interesting answers starting to emerge. This, though, is a world where we don't have systems right now that ensure preservation and archiving. This is a world where we are struggling, and again, I want to salute some of the leadership that was expressed in some of the white papers here, but we are struggling about the legitimacy of this material in promotion and tenure cases, about how to assess it and evaluate it, how to weigh it against more traditional publishing venues and activities. But this is coming. I mean, this is a wave that is going to just become enormous. And it's not, in my view, going to eliminate traditional printed monographs. It's not going to eliminate scholarly articles that are recognizable as journal articles, even though we actually may only print them on demand rather than printing them, binding them, and shipping them through the mail. What it instead means is that the traditional collection of books and journal articles is going to be an increasingly small piece of an increasingly diverse and complicated array of materials for representing and communicating scholarship. And the issues here are really extensive, they're deep, they push back into disciplinary culture and disciplinary practice. For example, think about issues that may be coming up in your discipline about reproducibility of experiments or analyses, about obligations or expectations that you will share data sets or software to interpret those data sets as a condition of publication. The various expectations that certain kinds of observational data become part of community-wide data banks under specific terms, both of time or publication. All of those kinds of things, and to be sure, they are, I think, more mature in the sciences than in some of the social sciences and humanities, where data is still, you know, passed down from advisor to advisee upon retirement, you know, in bizarre ways. At least they look bizarre to people who come from the sciences, where you can have, you know, spectacles like the Dead Sea Scrolls take place. Those are going to change. We're already seeing pressure for change. These are going to become important disciplinary issues. We're going to learn to author in a world where the readers are not just human beings, but are also machines. We're already doing that in a modest way, trying to get Google to index our stuff and return it in response to certain queries. You may or may not know that there indeed is a thriving industry of people, if you are a small business, that will help you restructure your website so that when somebody puts in a query for, you know, I don't know, you know, ceremonial teapots, you'll come up higher if that's what you sell. And a whole sort of arms race about how to make this, how to fake out the search engines. But the search engines are just the first dumb generation. We are also seeing data mining starting to happen. We're starting to see it happen in text mining, in the big pharmaceutical companies, in some of the major research labs. People are starting to unleash programs on literature or structured literature in conjunction with databases, trying to identify connections and hypotheses. We're going to need to learn to write for that environment, and how we do that is going to vary a great deal from discipline to discipline. But this big, big change, this learning how to write for the digital medium and learning when to write for it. Because personally, I don't expect, for example, books, real physical books with paper and pages to go away. There are certain arguments that I expect are going to work and certain kinds of communication that I suspect are going to work better in that framework for the foreseeable future. And yes, we may also put a copy of that book up on the net, you know, just for convenience, for demand printing, for consulting when you don't happen to have the physical one around. But the model we author for those kinds of works, may be turn the pages kind of books. We will, I believe, learn to author absolutely differently for other kinds of works. We're already seeing these things that are kind of like encyclopedias or reference works. They're also websites, but they have analytic elements to them that are popping up. We don't really have a good language for describing them. They're sort of a new genre of communicating scholarship, but they are clearly an important one in many disciplines. We also need to struggle with how we institutionalize the curation and preservation of this kind of material. This means institutional repositories, it means disciplinary repositories in some cases. It means working out sensible divisions of labor and handoffs between disciplinary and institutional strategies where it makes sense. But again, let me move on from here, because I do want to touch on two other areas. The third area that I want to touch on deals with the raw material of future scholarship, and that is very much at risk. If you look at what our great research libraries collect, our archives, our other cultural memory organizations, they really do two things. They document scholarship, of course. They preserve the records of scholarship, but they also preserve enormous amounts of raw material for future scholars. Just think of the amount of money that the National Endowment of Humanities, for example, has very rationally, in my view, devoted to capturing the newspaper history of the nation. Newspapers are important primary sources for an enormously wide range of scholarship: history, political science, sociology, economics, regional and city planning, all kinds of things. The wonderful old days where libraries had a clear path to collect these is falling apart. A great deal now of this raw material is video sorts of things. It's tied up in networks. It's tied up in 100-year copyrights. It's tied up in distribution channels that basically let other institutions decide when it's going to be visible, when it's not going to be visible, when it's going to vanish from the market, vanish from the sight of scholars. Yet we're in an environment now where, for example, we have scholarly disciplines like film and video studies. Have you ever looked at film studies or talked to those folks? They want to talk about movies, and they can't get the rights to reproduce even single shots from the movies. They have no particular good path to getting the movies they want to write criticism of, that they want to do analysis of. This is a public policy problem, in my view, first and foremost. And obviously, there are lots of players here who are interested in leveraging every bit of income that they can from these resources, manipulating the availability of them for one reason or another. I think that it is very important that the scholarly community continue to serve as a voice to put the consequences of this on the table in terms of not just our inability to do good scholarship about the way we live today, the way we thought yesterday, but really, you know, sort of the broader public policy implications here. And I think that this is one that the world of higher education and research and scholarship isn't going to win. There's no easy win here. What this is it's an unwieldy balance between a lot of conflicting interests. But I can tell you that there's certainly lots of other interests that are talking very loudly, and the implications of this for scholarship and inquiry are not being talked about enough. So I put that out as another part of the puzzle here. We may be able to do okay within the circle of material that we author and we reuse and we share among each other. But scholarship, you know, isn't bounded like that. It also constantly is taking in out of the broader culture. And it's easy in focusing about problems inside our system to forget our interdependence with the much bigger media system and publishing system and communication system. And that takes me to my last set of issues. And this is about bad behavior inside our own system. We talk about copyright law, for example, and we forget that if we own the rights or control the rights to material, copyright is a floor, it's not a ceiling. Let me just give you a few examples of the kinds of things that are very much on my mind here, and I'd invite you to think about other good examples. Many of our scholarly societies are professional societies, and by and large, they are ours. We fund them. We provide their boards. We need to take responsibility for what they do. But Some of these societies you will see now in their publications include things roughly to this effect: copyright, whatever the society is. Free use may be made of this material for personal research, for classroom teaching and instruction, or for other nonprofit purposes. And you can bicker a little bit about the precise scope of that. But what they're saying is they own the copyright, and they are simply going to make it, they're simply making a blanket statement. You don't have to talk to us about this. We're opening this material up for this kind of use because it's consistent with the mission of our society. It's what we're supposed to be doing. If your society isn't saying things like that, you need to talk about the implications of this, about whether the society's behavior is consistent with the values of the people, the institutions, and the funding sources that own or should own these societies. And I think this is a conversation that we desperately need to have. The problem isn't just some expensive commercial publishers. The problem goes much deeper. It's about setting up barriers to the free flow and reuse of materials in research and education. And you know, we ourselves are as guilty as anybody here. And I think we really need to look at that behavior. Let's talk about university presses. Now, there is a particularly bad form of behavior that has become popular in the publishing industry. Once upon a time, if you, as an author, quoted a few sentences or a paragraph from someone else, you would say, "This is fair use," and your publisher would say, "Yeah, it's fair use." And everybody would say, "Yes, and if some lunatic sues us for it, you know, we'll deal with the problem." In today's risk-averse environment, instead, we tell the author often that they're responsible for acquiring permissions for each sentence and paragraph they quote. So I'm sure you have better things to do than write nice letters and follow them up and follow them up and follow them up with publishers who don't respond to you in order to allow you to make fair, what I would view naively, not being an attorney, as fair use of a paragraph of prose. It's gotten worse too. Not only do these folks not answer you, sometimes when they do answer you, they say, "Oh yeah, we have a $50 permission fee for that." So you get nickeled and dimed all of these, you know, $25, $50 fees. Now, we know how stupid this is because it's costing more than that to write the check, deposit the check, account for it, and do all the overhead functions. What this is doing is it's wasting enormous amounts of everyone's time. It's wasting the time of our scholars. It's delaying the dissemination of scholarship. Why are we doing it? Why in particular are our university presses indulging in this kind of behavior if we indeed own them in the same way that we own the societies? That's something we really ought to think about. And yes, I realize that, you know, university presses have gone through this sort of deliberate cycle of torment to make them schizophrenic, where periodically somebody says, "Well, we're pulling all your subvention funding and you have to make a profit and run like a business," and then the next year they beat them up for not publishing enough material that is scholarly, i.e. by definition, loses money. We owe it on the other side to the presses to figure out whether we're really going to own them or whether we really want them to go be commercial entities. But this business of permissions and things, this is crazy. We can stop this within the circle of universities. I don't know that we can make, you know, Random House stop doing this for people within the academy who want to quote from there, but let's start by getting our own house in order on this. And university presses aren't the only, you know, bad actors here, or people who are behaving badly sometimes. Many universities have museums. Why isn't that material on the web or images of it? Why, again, are we creating complex barriers for its use? We really need to think through alignment of mission and values here. And this is my fourth theme. This is a complicated, you know, messy business, and everybody will tell you reasons why they can't do it. But they can do it. We can change this. Some scholarly societies have changed this already. There are good actors in this area. But this is one of these things where I think inside the world of scholarship and cultural heritage, we need to take a lot more responsibility for overseeing the appropriate behavior and the alignment of values for things that we ultimately are collectively responsible for. So those are the big four themes that I would put out there for you: economics and cost, the overwhelming, deep, wide, and extremely varied effects of new scholarly practices and the concomitant new practices of disseminating and documenting that scholarship. The linkage between the needs of the scholarly world and the much broader world outside, the world where scholarly markets are only a tiny fraction of the overall marketplace, but where having that access to materials is very important for the long-term health of the society and very much in jeopardy today. And then this concerted attempt to eliminate barriers, friction, and unreasonable sorts of overheads within spheres where we can control them, to try and create a more rational sphere for the actual sharing and advancement of scholarship. I hope that those themes resonate. I'm pretty sure that some parts of them at least do resonate with some of you, because I think they link very directly to some of the things that you raise and identify and frame and describe in the papers that you've prepared for this convocation. I hope in particular that you'll try and find a little time to give some consideration as part of your deliberations to each of these areas, because I do think each of them are important. And with that, I will stop. I would welcome questions, arguments, discussion. Please. Yes?
Well, you didn't mention sort of the old, the patent process here, but should I give you a license to sort of say some things about relationships between sort of scholarly productivity and especially universities and sort of the being sort of caught between this rock and a hard place of having to generate more income and sort of pressing faculty and staff to push for patents as well as just copyright?
Oh, yes, we were chatting a little about this earlier, and this is a very important area. Now, historically, you know, one could sort of safely say patents are a specialized area that doesn't really have that much to do with scholarship and scholarly communication. I'm sad to say that that's increasingly no longer true. On the one hand, you have got a patent system which, at least in my personal view, is completely out of control and badly broken, and where patents seem to be issued, you know, haphazardly by people who know nothing about what's been done in the field for the past 50 years. There have been some, I would note also, some very good studies lately about just how broken this system is from the National Academy in particular. There was a symposium, actually, in the beginning of January called Knowledge and the Knowledge Economy that was put on at the National Academies jointly with the OECD, where there were a number of looks at the effects of patents and how they interacted with university activities in some specific areas. Universities certainly are eager for income, and some of them view patents as an income source. I'm not expert here, but I have been told, actually, that while it's become very popular to have technology transfer offices, that relatively few of them are bringing in a lot of revenue to the university. There are a few universities that really have made huge amounts of revenue from patents, mostly in biotechnology areas. But then it's a long trail that isn't bringing in enormous amounts. I think that there's room for some hard thinking about and discussion among faculty and between faculty and administration about how aggressively you want to patent what kinds of things, and what kinds of things should just be put out in the open literature as documented art over which no patents are asserted. The really sad thing, though, is that patents, I think, are really starting to become a big problem for research in a number of the information science and computer science areas, for example, where these sort of nuisance patents show up. Now, the really big companies have portfolios of defensive patents, so they sort of say to each other, well, if you go after me, I'll go after you, and anyway, we have these monstrous legal departments that can grind away, but the trouble is everybody else is just at risk of becoming roadkill there. I don't know what we do about that. I guess if I was feeling really radical, one of the things that I might suggest bears some thinking about is that I believe that there is pretty broad acceptance that free speech and free inquiry are core academic values and are viewed as so core that most university administrations, if their faculty are challenged on these things, would say, this is so vital, we need to back up the faculty and take on this lawsuit and defend it. I'd like to believe that, at least. Now, I actually think that some of these questions about fair use and taking a reasonably aggressive view of fair use, about people trying to pull patent extortion on you with ridiculous patents, I think these run very close to this sort of threat to core values of free speech and free inquiry. And I think that one of the things that probably is important is to try and have some conversations to understand how those connect and to help figure out how aggressively universities need to and are willing to defend those kind of values in those contexts. I think right now they're sort of viewed as disconnected things by many trustees and administrators, and I don't think they are anymore.
I'd like to follow up on that. Just mention the Creative Commons and a discussion called the Science Commons that opens this sort of way of placing patents in an open way. And so science.creativecommons.org is that, and they have a lot of good documentation from a lot of smart lawyers who want to see these areas of inquiry kept open. And this follows on to their, as you were mentioning, the licenses that allow sharing and non-commercial sharing. Those are already devised for people that want to use it through the Creative Commons. We probably have several hundred contributors that I believe are using these, from musicians to people just writing blogs to Project Gutenberg has its own license.
Yeah, we have the tools.
You don't really, if you want, there are already models to work for that are already tested and work on national levels and are there. And there's also some discussion in infrastructure, deep thought about this out there that will help you. It doesn't mean you have to accept what they've done, but it's pretty smart people thinking and working on it for a little while. Larry Lessig and James Bull from Duke and others. So that's probably just what I wanted to put on there. I'm also curious to know who are the good acting societies that you mentioned. You mentioned some societies are good acting. And I think there are a couple, but I'm curious.
I haven't made a real systematic survey of societies. I think that ACM, for example, which I've had some dealings with over the years, is trying hard to do that. Now, every society who does this is doing this sort of, very, very delicate balancing act with their revenue stream, to be sure. But I think that I think that, for example, ACM has been relatively good in this area. I would point out that I think that some of the things really close to home have been pretty good in this area. EDUCAUSE, for example, has very, very clear policies about trying to make their material as useful as possible broadly among their community. Those are just a couple that cross my mind. I really haven't studied it. I do want to note one other thing, though. I'm glad you mentioned the Creative Commons. I had intended to. They have got a number of these sort of sample licenses that you can use to try and make material available for a specific set of uses that don't necessarily include commercial reappropriation by someone else. There is some real benefit, I think, to trying to use standardized terms where possible. Every one of these societies that's behaving well seems to come up with slightly different language, which means that people who aren't legal experts have to sort of puzzle over it a bit, and it would be much better if we could agree on some standard language, a la Creative Commons. And, I can't speak for Creative Commons, but my sense is that they certainly would be open to continuing to work with the higher education world if there are more things we need than the set of licenses that they have available now. I know that they've already had some fairly extensive conversations with people at MIT, for example, who were trying to apply it in their DSpace institutional repository implementation. So I do think that notion of looking at relatively standard terms is helpful. Yes?
Would you say something about how your things are inflected by being a practitioner, a knowledge producer within the public university? How would you see what you've said, how will it change the conversation we'll have with, say, legislatures about benefits and costs of knowledge production?
That's a really interesting question. One of the things that seems clear is that state-supported institutions, public institutions of higher education, have got some real interesting sets of communications issues with their legislature, and not just with their legislature, but with the people at large. I'm hearing a lot of interest, actually, in things like institutional repositories, open access, etc., as ways of making the institution's contributions more visible to the citizens and taxpayers of the state. Now, one of the hard things here, frankly, is that in a network world, geography is getting weaker and weaker. And, so you have this sort of arrangement right now where public universities are funded by a state, by a tax base, you know, in geographical proximity to it, in essence. Yet, when you open up your stuff, when you showcase your contributions, when you contribute to knowledge, it contributes not just to the state, but to all the world. And that's a very tough balance that I think we're going to need to help people struggle with the fact that that's probably good in the long term. One of the things I'm watching with great interest now is states starting to move more heavily into science funding of their own. The stem cell initiatives, for example, and the positions that are going to be taken about whether to try and productize that as a revenue source for the state or to contribute it back to the overall base of knowledge. And that, you know, obviously at some level they'll do both. The question is what kind of a balance they'll see. I do think that it's not just science and technology too. I think that our institutions of higher education contribute a great deal to the intellectual and cultural and artistic life of the states and the world. And one of the things I really hope is that we can open up more of that through network dissemination strategies, repositories, through the documentation of public events. I mean, actually, Paul has been, you know, I think one of the sort of leaders in doing some of that and making it available. I'll say one more thing, which is when I talk with provosts and presidents, I hear an increasing emphasis on terms like civic engagement. Thinking, you know, the asking of questions about how can information technology strategies improve that and leverage that. So it is something that I think is very much on the minds of policymakers. Yeah.
I'm the director of UNC Press.
Yes.
And so, if I may, I'd just like to comment on a couple of your remarks. The first is that I really appreciated your good words about the enormous value that University Press is going to their nonprofit publishing. And I think that the humanities authors in the room have firsthand experience with that. I also thank you for bringing attention to the difficulty that university presses have in publishing in small market areas. It's a huge crisis. We as publishers, we as scholarly publishers, feel it every bit as much as you all as authors and as teachers of this material do. So I thank you very much for making note of that. And also, as a past president of the Association of American University Presses, I thank you for your comments about the kind of schizophrenic attitude that some parent institutions have towards the funding and the mission of university presses. It's a huge problem for us, and it reverberates through your world. But I also want to just say a couple of things about the permissions issue. And this is going to relate to how we operate at UNC Press, but I have some familiarity with other presses, so it's not a wholly unique perspective. We try to help educate our authors about what constitutes fair use, and we try to help them learn to identify the material for which they do not have to seek permission. As Dr. Lynch said, once you ask permission, if there's a fee attached, you're stuck. If you educate yourself about what constitutes fair use, apply that prudently, you're in a far stronger position. And university presses feel a big responsibility to educate our authors as the seekers of permission in that connection. But we also sit on the other side of the street. We do try to keep our fees modest. I'm not sure you'd feel better about the commission situation if instead of 25 and 50, it was 250 and $500 for commissions. We do try to take into account who's seeking permission and for what purpose. And the third thing I just wanted to mention on that is that we're charged with the responsibility as a publisher to protect our author's intellectual property, that's all of your work, and to share with you the fees that we collect for commissions. So I take your point, but it's a more complicated question, I think.
Yes, and I wanted to point at it here. I really don't think it's fair for us to debate it. I would just invite you. Here is someone who actually makes these kind of policies. You can have a really good talk sometime tomorrow. I just invite you to try some mental scenarios. You probably have some idea what you take in per year in low-level permissions and what it costs to collect it. And, you know, by this I don't mean taking an entire book, translate it into Japanese, and publish it in this market. I mean this nuisance permission business. And many of you are authors. You probably, you know, get an exciting $10 check once a year for your, permission reuse. Or hey, maybe this is more profitable than I know. And you're getting your second Mercedes with the check. I don't know, but you could actually have the argument about how important is it to you to get those checks. How important is it for you to get that revenue? The alternative might very well be to dump a little subvention to replace that and just eliminate the entire friction. These are the kinds of things we need to talk about, and we haven't been talking about them systematically. And that's where I aim to go with this.